For the next hour and a half, you'll be hearing two presentations and a response to them. The first paper will be given by Kira Pratt Davis, who's a graduate student in English at BYU. Her paper is entitled The Marriage of Adam and Eve, The Male-Female Dichotomy in Mormon Doctrine. The second paper will be presented by Michael Harward, who's... you have your MA in Humanities, correct? At the University of Chicago. And his topic is Priesthood and the Male Position. A response after both of the papers will be given by John M. Lear, who's a board member of the B.H. Roberts Society. After John's response, he will moderate questions and comments from you if there is enough time for that. Eve is perhaps the most maligned of all women in the scriptures. She's been referred to as lewd, gluttonous, that cackler Eve, especially if we go back to the medieval literature in the church. Eve seems to have the worst reputation of all the women. She fares slightly better with Mormons than with most Christians. We believe that she was a bit stupid, but fortunately there was a plan set up that took her gullibility into account from the beginning. In short, Eve gets all the blame, and Adam comes off as somewhat of a hero. Adam fell that men might be, but Eve was beguiled. Yet another closer look at Eve and at Adam, too, reveals something deeper than mere beguilement and unselfish heroics at work. The behavior of Adam and Eve in the garden is archetypally appropriate. In Adam and Eve, particularly in our Mormon Adam and Eve, we see quite plainly the workings of a basic dichotomy, male and female. The dichotomy first became apparent to me as I was studying the work of the Romantics in English literature, particularly William Blake. He wrote a very peculiar treatise, kind of a poem, kind of a fantasy, called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which amounts to a broadly depicted showdown between a masculine heaven, which is critical, analytical, orthodox, obedient, and abstract, and a feminine hell, which is impulsive, creative, intuitive, relative, and personal. He doesn't directly state the genders of heaven and hell. He never comes out and says that heaven is masculine, hell is feminine. This can be inferred, however, from the fact that he calls it a marriage of the two, and Blake was not one to condone a marriage that would not be male and female. Also, these genders are implied by traditional literary treatments of masculine and feminine. As I go on, I think this will become more clear, but principally I want to make sure that this isn't misunderstood, that the feminine, in this sense, does not refer to a trait that is characteristic of all women. It's mostly a literary feminism. You see people like the Lady of the Lake, like the Muses, things like this, things that are representative of the creative, the intuitive, the impulsive. Anyway, I think you'll see what I mean as I go on. Our Adam is very like Blake's heaven. Our Eve is very like Blake's hell. Heaven and Adam are good, which Blake defines as the passive which obeys reason. While hell and Eve are evil, or, as Blake puts it, the active springing from energy, it becomes obvious that Blake prefers hell. His heaven is full of rather self-important angels whose usual state is righteous indignation. The Mormon Adam and Eve are right at home in heaven and hell. Consider the temptation scene. Adam doesn't even listen to Satan, doesn't ask who he is or consider his logic in the least, but goes on his way firm in his passive obedience to the general commandment. Eve, on the other hand, is curious. She wants to know who Satan is and what he's come to do. When he tells her the forbidden fruit will give her knowledge and make her wise and as the gods, knowing good and evil, she senses intuitively that there is no other way and acts out of a relative view of expediency, out of energy, rather than out of a general passive obedience. It was rash, certainly, but as the devils in Blake's Hell express in one of their proverbs, the road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. Wisdom Eve gained after it was all over. It was better to pass through sorrows, learn good and evil, and have children. Eve seems to recognize the difference between her way of thinking and Adam's way of thinking. When she comes to him with the forbidden fruit, she doesn't present the argument that convinced her that it would make them wise and like the gods. She instead, perhaps sensing that Adam was not capable of accepting an intuitive argument, offers something more concrete. It's delicious. Try it. When that doesn't work, she catches him with a reasonable argument. Blake would call it analytic, something his angels were very fond of. If he didn't take the fruit, too, he would be all alone in the garden and would be disobeying the other commandment, to multiply and replenish the earth. Heavenly reasoning won out, and Adam partook. Eve further showed her hellish nature by recognizing Satan in what seems to have been a flash of intuitive insight. But then, when the Lord comes, both intuition and analytics dwindle away as they run off and hide, and Adam blames Eve, and Eve blames the serpent for the taking of the fruit. Intuitive reasoning has a way of sounding very unreasonable under any kind of pressure. It seems that up to this point, Adam and Eve weren't very married. They went their separate ways until they took the fruit. This non-married, uncooperative state appears in Blake's Heaven and Hell, too, flying in the face of Blake's title, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. In The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, heaven has attempted to cancel hell. And in the Garden of Eden, Eve has run way ahead of Adam. Now, in Blake, the strife between heaven and hell came about because reason expelled desire. It indeed appeared to reason as if desire was cast out, but desire made its own place, hell, and sneered at the stuffy angels in heaven and their rule-bound self-righteousness. The expulsion of desire left heaven barren, analytical, and oppressive, ashamed of desire and imagination and anxious to be rid of them. Heaven without hell was dead, static, unproductive. The unmarried behavior of Adam and Eve in the garden was unproductive too, though the imbalance was on the other side, Eve, or hell, being the one that was taking the initiative rather than heaven. Eve ran unchecked with her energy and intuition at full throttle, while Adam remained practically inert. It was like the motor running off without the steering wheel or dragging the steering wheel along behind it. And like the unmarried condition of Blake's Heaven and Hell, this condition in the garden could only lead to imbalance and spiritual and physical sterility. But at that point, the Lord took hold of the situation and married Adam and Eve, fixing the steering wheel firmly in control of the motor by having Eve promise to obey Adam in righteousness, whatever that means. Blake, on the other hand, never married his heaven and hell. He left them quite divorced. The closest he came to a real marriage is one particular scene in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell where he depicts Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane, praying for the comforter, or desire, so that reason might have ideas to build upon. But other than that, he never really marries his heaven and hell. Perhaps he intended to shake people up enough to marry heaven and hell in society, to reincorporate a little hellish desire, imagination, and pity into what seemed to Blake to be a very harsh, structured society, the blame for which could be placed mostly on the Puritan church, which was in control at the time. The Adam and Eve, heaven and hell dichotomy has many possible applications, aside from this analysis of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. If we take seriously the suggestion given to us in the temple that we consider ourselves as if we were Adam and Eve, we can build on the Adam and Eve story and use it as a psychic allegory. Several basic ideas of modern psychology use the same dichotomy of male and female qualities. W.H. Auden once said that the whole of Freud's teachings may be found in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And if heaven and hell are related to Freud, our Adam and Eve could be too. Blake's heaven and our Adam correspond roughly to Freud's superego, the analytical, sensorial aspects of the ego, conscience. Blake's hell and Eve correspond roughly to Freud's id, the subconscious drives and desires, the source of poetic imagination, the realm of dreams, and subconscious intuitive knowledge. It is significant, when Eve is compared to the id, to remember that Eve was taken out of Adam's sleep, the realm of the subconscious, and near his heart, the traditional seat of the emotions. Adam and Eve can represent the two major forces in the human psyche, the creative and the analytical, Blake's desire and reason. As most human beings are aware, these two forces often, like Adam and Eve or like heaven and hell, behave in a most unmarried fashion. In its broadest terms, Freudian psychoanalytic treatment consists of reconciling heaven to the feelings of hell, of marrying heaven and hell, or Adam and Eve, in order to produce a healthy ego. Carl Jung, one of Freud's most distinguished followers, saw in the union of the male and female tendencies of the mind the transcendent function of the psyche, by which a person can achieve the full realization of the potential of his individual self. Jung traced in fairy tales and myths the struggle of the psyche to find and marry its different aspects. For example, in fairy tales, there's a call, an adventure, a risk, a dragon or two, or an ogre, or even death on the way to the Chapel Perilous, the castle, the bridal bower. The wanderer succeeds at last by a hair and wins the maiden or the prince. He or she finds was with him or her all the while. The inevitable marriage is a symbolic union of the two halves of the hero he always had, but found finally in the dens of dragons how to reconcile. Until the wanderer learns to marry both halves, he is a lopsided creature, creatively barren, given to extreme behavior. Only in the union of the two halves can a person be truly productive. The structure must balance the feeling. Control must cooperate with desire. Another implication of the marriage of heaven and hell and of Adam and Eve can be arrived at by looking at directly at Mormon doctrine. The first one that comes to mind is Lehi's, but also an opposition of opposing qualities in the thing itself. Eloise Bell recently wrote an article for Sunstone in which she discusses the nature and purpose of opposition. She interprets Lehi's statement that there must be opposition in all things in a very enlightening way. And I quote from Eloise Bell. Lehi says, "It must needs be that there is an opposition in all things. Notice, in all things, not to. Could we restate this to say that in all aspects of life there must be, and there is, a mixture of good and bad, right and wrong, holiness and misery? This mixture, or this opposition of qualities, produces a state of constant motion, movement, interchange, growth, or in short, life." Lehi explains if it should be one body, that is, if there were not this compound of qualities, it must needs remain as dead, having no life, neither death. Joseph Campbell, who's a pretty well-renowned contemporary anthropologist, summarizes the basic concept of Taoism as the same sort of life-giving opposition. And I quote from Joseph Campbell. Yang, the light, active, masculine principle, and yin, the dark, passive, and feminine, in their interaction underlie and constitute the whole world of forms. They proceed from and together make manifest Tao, the source and law of being. Tao means road or way. Tao is the way or course of nature, destiny, cosmic order, the absolute made manifest. Tao is therefore also truth and right conduct. Tao inhabits every created thing. So without the opposition of yin and yang, Tao could not exist. As Lehi says, all things must needs remain as dead. But perhaps the most far-reaching application of this marriage of heaven and hell and of Adam and Eve can be found in the Book of Mormon discussions of Christ's atonement. Lehi, once again in the opposition discourse, describes the workings of a law that sounds very heavenly in the Blakean sense. And by the law, no flesh is justified, or by the law, men are cut off. Yea, by the temporal law they were cut off, and also by the spiritual law they perish from that which is good and become miserable forever. Apparently, justice is absolute. It tolerates no deviation. Lehi presents a solution to the inflexibility of heavenly justice in the next verse. Wherefore, redemption cometh in and through the Holy Messiah, for he is full of grace and truth. The structure of the sentence implies that grace and truth are the mitigating influence, for he is full of grace and truth. Grace is, of course, mercy. Truth in this context, as some kind of antidote for the harshness of the law, may be a relative, personal view of the sinner, compassion, understanding, and a good hard look at extenuating circumstances. The Messiah, in this sense, marries masculine law and feminine grace and truth to produce a unified, fruitful creation. Fruitful in the sense of able to produce resurrected, exalted beings. Once again, marriage means fertility. Alma discusses the atonement in much the same terms. There's a great dilemma, how to satisfy the two opposing forces, justice and mercy. And I quote from Alma. According to justice, the plan of redemption could not be brought about only on conditions of repentance of men in this probationary state. For except it were for these conditions, mercy could not take effect except it should destroy the work of justice. Now the work of justice could not be destroyed. If so, God would cease to be God. But Alma presents the solution in the next verse. Therefore, God himself atoneth for the sins of the world to bring about the plan of mercy to appease the demands of justice. That God might be a perfect, just God, and a merciful God also. Apparently, God himself must maintain a balance of justice and mercy, of masculine and feminine. He too must marry these opposing qualities. Alma even assigns to justice and mercy the appropriate genders. Justice exerciseth all his demands, and mercy claimeth that which is her own. Now, the male-female, heaven and hell, Adam-Eve dichotomy runs not only through doctrinal aspects of the church, but we encounter it in daily practical things as well. Personal revelation is a hellish, Eve-ish function, linked as it is with emotions in the subconscious. While priesthood manuals obviously come from heaven. The masculine MTC stands juxtaposed against the feminine sacred grove. Sometimes I wonder if we're developing an upper crust of heaven that belies our basically hellish nature as a church, that we are based on revelation, on Eve, on intuition, and on a union of those opposing qualities. In all things, heaven needs hell, and hell needs heaven. Neither is the man without the woman, nor the woman without the man, if I may wrench that out of context momentarily, in the Lord. If it isn't this way, there's an imbalance. You get fascism on the one hand and anarchy on the other. Eve must be reinstated next to Adam as a flexible, dynamic, imaginative force, equal in importance to Adam's rationality, if we are to be truly married. Thank you.
The relatively recent rise in the number of discussions about Mormon women and their roles vis-a-vis the church and the gospel can and ought to be seen as an attempt to bring into question assumptions too long held of the Mormon woman's place in her society. These discussions demonstrate an affinity with the efforts of other Christian feminist theologians, such as the early Valerie Saving and the recent Judith Plasko. Both Mormon and non-Mormon sources present vibrant theological articulations of the roles of women, yet pallid, unsubstantial treatments of male roles. Moreover, discussions about Mormon men and the priesthood by Mormon men generally share this negligence. It is my contention that there exists a conflation of the terms priesthood, maleness, and fatherhood in most Mormon circles. Not only are the components themselves problematic, the admixture itself is often unwarranted. This confusion stems less from doctrinal misunderstanding of the priesthood than from cultural prejudices coloring the definitions of maleness and fatherhood. I want to bring into question these assumptions by referring to Saving and Plasko, to Mormon canonical statements about the priesthood, and lastly and largely to personal experience and reflection. The question underlying the entire discussion will be, is there anything inherently male about the priesthood? My intent is to show that there is not. Virginia Woolf tells of her astonishment upon opening the British Museum catalog to women and describes the scores of works written, mostly by men. Simone de Beauvoir even suggests that, quote, a man would never get the notion of writing a book on the peculiar situation of the human male. And, Judith Plasko adds, apparently no woman would either. Plasko continues, no one writes books about men as men because men as men are not mysterious. They do not need to be explained. Why should they? All books are about men, i.e. human beings. Man, the male animal, that being well delineated, articulated, appreciated, and completely understood. All has been written, all has been said, all is known. On first consideration, it would seem that the innumerable pronouncements and philosophizings about man, red male of the species, can hardly be considered part of men's experience. Even the best pronouncements seldom reflect the richness and complexity of his experience. But as limited as these definitions may be, the definitions enter into the lives of men in many ways. The wisdom all these pronouncements express arises out of and is reabsorbed into the general social mythology concerning men, which is part of the cultural air we breathe. Not only is there no direction in which men can turn without bumping into others' expectations of them, but also in the course of their education and growth, men internalize these expectations. There has been no men's experience in isolation or abstraction from them. Men have known themselves and the world only in lived relation to these definitions of men and men's possibilities. These definitions have thus come to form a part of men's experience. But while there has been no men's experience apart from these definitions, men's experience and the definitions are not simply the same. The relation between them has most certainly been a living and complex one. Each man has had to compromise with and adjust to his culture's understanding of his role, or has had to struggle within or against it. Most often, men have accepted and lived within the limits of society's definitions of them. Their compromises have, for the most part, been invisible. On the other hand, there have been times when experiences of men have contradicted these definitions, and in this way judged them and shown forth their restrictiveness. This is most obviously true in history's great men, the Albert Schweitzers, the Gandhis, the Christs. Here I have a footnote that says the preceding two paragraphs are essentially rewrites of Plasko's dissertation, except I substituted the word men for every time she had the word women. And I think they're both applicable. John Ruskin once outlined the cultural definitions of men which surrounded my own adolescence and to some extent my present situation. Quote, "The man's power is active, progressive, defensive. He is eminently the doer, the creator, the discoverer, the defender. His intellect is for speculation and for invention. His energy for adventure, for war, for conquest." Close quote. A male teenager in Blackfoot, Idaho, played basketball, was an Eagle Scout, a church and civic leader, and studied either electronics shop, agriculture, or physics, chemistry, calculus. He did not sew, cook, play the viola, take ballet, or cry. If he did, he built elaborate mechanisms to disguise or rationalize, if not hide, the fact. He had a part-time job so he could buy a car, which he took to college, where he enrolled in ROTC and went on a mission. He and his collegiate comrades would have confirmed the study of Rosencrantz, who, when they surveyed undergraduate men and women, found that men were defined as dominant, aggressive, independent, active, unemotional and objective, worldly and knowledgeable, loud, rough, blunt, and sloppy. The social mythology of masculinity influenced this young man and his friends, and his own experience either reinforced the mythology or became inconsequential to it. Some rebelled and established their own definitions and roles, but they remained and remain the exceptional, the unusual, the different. Though recognized as men, they hold a status apart. Valerie Saving, whose 1960 article, The Human Situation, A Feminine View, gave voice, direction, and attention to the feminist theology movement, uses sex role distinction as the basis of her argument, and she appeals to Margaret Mead for justification. Saving thinks that the processes of sex role differentiation fit Mead's description of, quote, "real differences that exist in addition to the obvious anatomical and physical ones, but just as biologically based, that may be masked by the learning appropriate to any given society, but which will nevertheless run through all of man's and all of woman's behavior," close quote. In every society, Saving claims, the mother is closest to the infant. The young boy's process of differentiation from his mother is different from his sister's in that, quote, "instead of imitating her, his mother, he must relinquish completely his original identification with her. He also finds that while he is not and never will be a woman, neither is he yet a man. It will be years before he can perform sexually as a man, and therefore he does not need to be guarded like his sister against sexual activity before he is ready for it. He is thus permitted far greater freedom than the girl. But this freedom has its drawbacks for him. True, he has certain advantages over the girl, particularly in the fact that he has visible organs which demonstrate his sex. But on the whole, the process of self-differentiation plays a stronger and more anxiety-provoking role in the boy's maturation than is normally the case for the girl. Growing up is not merely a natural process of bodily maturation. Close quote. This process of self-differentiation from the mother figure leads ultimately to passive-active distinction in female-male sexuality. The natural process of bodily maturation in girls, Sabin concludes, leads to passivity in female sexuality. Definite sexual events happen to a woman. First menstruation, defloration, impregnation, childbirth, lactation, menopause. Though not the purpose of this paper, it could be and ought to be argued that impregnation, childbirth, and lactation are hardly passive and that menopause is all but definite. I will argue, however, with her statement that the boys, that quote, the boy's history will provide no such dramatic once for all physical signals of his masculinity, close quote. Men experience a once for allness with the first shave, first ejaculation, and or loss of virginity. There certainly is no literary dearth of men's first encounter with sexual intercourse, from Tom Jones to Kierkegaard. Hair growth, voice change, wet dreams, impotency happen as passively to men as menstruation and menopause to women. Sabin claims that in the sexual act itself, whereas a woman need not participate actively, though she may, quote, the case is quite otherwise for the male, whose active desire and active performance in the sexual act is absolutely required for its completion, close quote. A woman's passivity is drastically evident in rape. Granted that women seldom rape men, prison rape, on the other hand, clearly suggests that male orgasm is not always and is thus not necessarily an active event. A man is as capable as any submissive and patronizing spouse of going through the motions of sexual intercourse, all the while emotionally and psychologically being very passive. A June 1981 review of the recently published The Height Report on Male Sexuality in Time magazine appears to lend support to this argument. Other fallacies are present in Sabin's argument of sexual differentiation. Particularly crucial, it seems, are not those fallacies involving the process of mother-child self-differentiation, but the boy-girl, brother-sister differences in sexual self-differentiation that her rhetoric implies. A boy, she claims, is not yet a man, but is a girl yet a woman? A small boy differentiates himself from his mother because of his genitals. Does not a small girl make an analogous sort of differentiation based on the absence of breasts and menstruation? A boy, again, she asserts, must wait several years before he can perform sexually as a man. Must not a small girl wait the same amount of time? And why is it not as necessary to guard a boy against sexual activity as his sister? Is there more young girl sexual abuse than young boy sexual abuse? The case of John Gacy seems to suggest not. Now, if you don't know, John Gacy was accused, and I don't know if he's been convicted, of, several dozens of bodies of young boys was found in the basement portion of his house in North Chicago. And finally, I see no particular advantage of a boy having, quote, visible organs which demonstrate his sex. On the contrary, I can think of more instances where it would be a disadvantage. Another type of fallacy has to do with the notion of freedom saving extends to the male of the species. Men's indirect and less binding role in the reproductive process accounts for this freedom, as well as producing an accompanying anxiety. I do not question the freedom nor the anxiety. I rather question again the rhetoric which implies that this freedom distinguishes male from female. The invalid corollary to men's freedom is women's bondage, i.e., men have more choices than women. An example from my own life may help demonstrate this fallacy. One of my first encounters with the issues presented through the women's movement came one evening a few years ago in the company of my wife and three other couples, one of whom was more newlywed than we, another newly engaged, and the third newly introduced. After listening to the broadcast of the BYU 12-stake fireside, instead of discussing the speech as planned, we examined our perceptions of women and their careers, particularly Mormon women. In terms of Mormon women, the evening was not necessarily an enlightening one, was not necessarily enlightening for me, because I already felt enlightened on the subject. My mother worked from the time I started first grade, and I never felt deprived in my relationship with her, nor in the formulation of my morals and values. I have developed as a result a certain independence that I appreciate. The thing that intrigued me about this evening with my friends was the notion of choice underlying the whole discussion. We concentrated, unconsciously, on the choice Mormon women have between a career or none. As is often the case with Nancy, my wife, and me, the conversation continued as we walked home, got ready for, and into bed. As I contemplated this choice, it became clear to me why I had had such a difficult time coming to a decision regarding my own career. I had no such choice. I, as a man, because of the cultural air I breathed, had to have a career. I had no option and had never had. No one, of course, was forcing me to have a career. We as a couple could choose, as friends of ours have, to reverse roles. The lawyer wife is the provider and the husband is the homemaker. But because that decision defies and renounces the cultural mythology, a price must be paid, and is, by our friends. They are strange, odd, apart, different, and even ridiculed. That a wife and mother works is more socially accepted today than previously, but that a husband and father willingly chooses to stay home is still out of harmony with societal expectations. Men may have the choice as individual, authentic human beings to relinquish any career, but within the context of our cultural mythology, they have no such choice. That men have more freedom than women, then, is fallacious. Plasko shares many of Savings' fallacies, as well as a rhetoric which suggests the syllogism, women are A, men and men are not A, therefore men and women are different. I have nothing against differences, I do not wish to deny them. I am, however, wary of statements of the general nature, men are. Because the exception is usually more prevalent than the rule. My wariness of such statements was concretized as a missionary. In the LTM, I learned many ways to complete the statement, the French are. After several months in the country itself, I learned that the French also have their Americans are clauses. Because I knew that most of their generalizations were invalid, it occurred to me that probably mine also were. Though many of the distinctions may be correct, the conclusion that the French have more in common with each other than they do with the Americans, or vice versa, is wrong. I have observed greater differences between two French people or two Americans than any of the Franco-American distinctions I was taught. A similar notion applies to male-female distinctions. Apart from the anatomical, physiological differences in the male and female of the human species, I am wary of any other general distinctions made. Or rather, I am wary of the conclusions made from such distinctions. That men have more in common with men just because they are men and women with women is fallacious, or at least non-essential. I am biologically different from every woman I know and will ever know. That fact, however, separates me less from many women I know than the psychological, emotional, spiritual, and intellectual separation I feel from many, if not most, men in the world. My best friend in high school was female. Few people understood that relationship, mainly because when a boy and a girl were friends, they were also potential marriage partners. We were just best friends. If the two were placed side by side, I would have to say that I was more like, i.e., less different from Mary Christensen than Bruce Hoban, my first roommate at college. And today, notwithstanding our differences, I am more like Nancy, my wife, than any other person I know. Male-female differences are undeniable, but beyond the anatomical, physiological ones, I am inclined to suggest that the differences are human differences, i.e., similar to the differences that exist in male-male or female-female relationships. Before leaving Savings and Plasko's treatments or mistreatments of men, let me suggest what I see to be basically wrong with their position, even more basic than their invalid portrayals of men. They have bound themselves to the tradition which they are trying to criticize by adopting its assumptions and language game, and therefore are really asking the wrong questions. My feeling is that for any future Saving or Plasko to have a profound effect, she needs to ask new questions which are unlimited by the current tradition of Tillich, Freud, and Masters and Johnson. She must not make the same mistake Wayne Booth made in a speech geared toward undergraduate women at the University of Chicago winter quarter 1980. The speech was entitled, "Is There Any Knowledge That a Woman Must Have?" The main point was that a woman needed to learn strategy, for strategy allowed one to win the game, i.e., to be successful within a tradition whose limits one cannot avoid once she begins playing by its rules. The underlying tone was that men exploit women, and a woman can only win via a well-executed strategy against that exploitation. Since the same men who exploit women also exploit other men, the situation is not going to be remedied by women in turn exploiting men and eventually other women. Not only are the rules of the game wrong, the game itself must be discarded, and an altogether new one begun, if not an already existing better one incorporated. Turning to the concept of fatherhood, one rightly supposes that I am similarly wary of the existing mythology and tradition which give it definition. Ashley Montague encapsulates the tradition by stating that whereas there is not the least doubt that women are by nature maternal, men are not. And why not? Cultural definitions and expectations have shoved boys outside the doors of the home and all but locked them out. His chores around the house are outside ones. He takes out the garbage, mows the lawn, paints the fence, and weeds the dandelions. He is not expected to dust, vacuum, or do the dishes. If he does these things, it is only as temporary assistance. They are not on the list of his expected contributions to the family. His list of part-time jobs rarely includes babysitting. Therefore, in all likelihood, before getting married, and often 10 years later, he has never changed a diaper, fed an infant, or rocked a baby to sleep. The unspoken assumption goes something like this: behold, the natural disposition of men is not maternal. Of course not. Maternal stems from mater, which means mother, and men are not mothers. Therefore, they are not maternal, non sequitur. We must not, however, fall victim to equating fatherhood and maternity. Likewise, neither must we necessarily equate motherhood with what maternity has come to mean. I was pleased to receive a letter about a year ago from a well-educated French woman after the birth of her first child. Philippe believes in sharing everything, she says, down to the household tasks. Then the baby came, and I realized something that really shook me up. A man can have a maternal instinct, if you see what I mean. I guess I wasn't quite converted to what I preached, because it really surprised me to see my husband so well at ease with child care without any previous training. The problem with the terms father and fatherhood is that when they are discussed in conjunction with mother and motherhood, they are generally addressed on a completely different level. This, too, is a result of our cultural mythology, which colors our use of the terms. Whenever Saving, Plasko, and this year's Melchizedek Priesthood Personal Study Guide discusses women, it is in terms of women as mothers. Whenever men are discussed, it is in terms of men as political entities. Similarly, discussions of motherhood are creator, educator, and orientation, whereas discussions of fatherhood are businessmen, militarist in nature. The essence of fatherhood, like motherhood, is rooted in a genealogical cohesion of a family group, where the terms are primarily biological in nature. The only thing that appears to be inherent in the terms is that both, not just one or the other, serve as sex role models, although what those role models are is cultural specific. On the one hand, current Mormon cultural definitions of fatherhood parallel the rest of the Christian world. At the last stake priesthood meeting I attended, the Stake Relief Society president was asked to bear her testimony. Had she had time to prepare, I do not think that she would have made this slip. But that she did is indicative of how much our culture is ingrained in our souls. In essence, what I heard her say was, "Fathers, the only way any culture, bred artistic refinement, will come into your family is through your wives. Please support them." I was offended. Am I so unrefined and barbaric that I cannot teach my children to appreciate good music, art, dance, and literature? I'm sorry, you guys are too dry back here. I needed a drink between leaving the airport and getting downtown. On the other hand, Mormon theology adds new dimensions to parental roles. Parenthood is not merely a temporal phenomenon. Families are sealed as units for eternity, and the creation of offspring continues in the next life, though then it is spiritual rather than temporal. Since I cannot envision the need at that point for the economists, businessmen, and generals that are used to describe fatherhood, am I to conclude that fathers will have no role models to portray and nothing to do as fathers in the next life? Based upon the example of our own spiritual father, I think not. But what is his position as father? He is our creator and educator. My point is that creation, and particularly education, are not the exclusive domain of women. I do not think women have usurped the responsibility as much as it has been foisted upon them. What we call the maternal instinct, as my French friend concluded, is as instinctive in men as it is in women. The difference is that from the moment of birth, and probably prenatally, as some neonatologists would suggest, that the male infant is taught to suppress those instincts, while the female infant is taught to develop them. I agree with N. Eldon Tanner, who has said, "The happiest women I know are those whose families would rather be home than any place else, whose children come bounding in after school to look for mother to tell her about their activities of the day, who share the sorrows and joys and successes of those children, and rejoice in their accomplishments." Likewise, I feel that we should say, "The happiest men I know are those whose families would rather be home than any place else, whose children come bounding in to look for father, to tell him about their activities of the day, who share the sorrows and joys and successes of those children, and rejoice in their accomplishments." Our theology seems to suggest that we must not excuse fathers from what are normally called maternal traits, by assigning some other traits to their exclusive domain, e.g. provision and protection. Thus far, I have tried to delineate what I see to be the inadequacies and fallacies of our cultural mythology as it deals with the concepts of maleness and fatherhood. The restraints placed upon these concepts come from the language we use to define the terms men and father. The way in which we use the terms and concepts seems to be very clear and precise. The fact that we communicate leads us to believe that they are. I want to suggest that it is altogether uncertain what is really meant by the terms because of the inadequacies and fallacies that exist. The inadequacies and fallacies exist because crucial elements are excluded and non-essential items are given primacy. Because all Mormon men, unlike other Christians, hold the priesthood rather than rely upon a professional clergy, and because almost all Mormon men are fathers in observance of the Mormon doctrine of eternal marriage, and because all Mormon priesthood holders are male, there is a natural tendency in Mormon circles to conflate the terms maleness, fatherhood, and priesthood. Though all three apply to one half of the Mormon population, each refers to a separate and distinct aspect of the group. Maleness refers to man's biological position in nature. Fatherhood refers to man's position in the family. Priesthood refers to man's religious duty and responsibility. It is easy and convenient for the sake of symmetry to stack the three on top of each other. Maleness is on the bottom since one can be male and neither a father nor a priesthood holder. Fatherhood is in the middle, since being a father subsumes being male, without necessitating that one be a priesthood holder. And priesthood on top to cap the sequence, subsuming fatherhood and consequently maleness. This, however, as in earlier examples, is giving the non-essential elements of priesthood primacy. One of the most significant and influential comes from the too frequent coupling of priesthood and motherhood. Again, as we have already seen, we attempt to contrast and compare two concepts while addressing each at a very different level. While teaching humanities at BYU, I gave a specific writing assignment that always brought interesting results. The assignment was to compare and contrast two works of art of different genres. The typical paper followed this outline. Introduction. I wish to compare and contrast Raphael's The School of Athens and Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. Now, that's not bad. That's what I was looking for. Paragraph A. Raphael's painting is very good. The line is important as well as shape and color. Paragraph B. Tchaikovsky is an important composer. His use of sound and tone is very expressive and his rhythms are stunning. Conclusion. Both of these works of art are very important and rewarding because the creator of each is an excellent artist. My example is exaggerated, but the point remains that one cannot adequately and truthfully deal with two concepts while addressing them from different and often incompatible directions. Priesthood and motherhood are two such concepts. I am not even sure that they ought to be discussed in conjunction with each other. For one thing, where does that then put fatherhood? Furthermore, the conjunction can lead to the false equation of godhood and motherhood. In our temples, we learn of gods and goddesses, not gods and mothers. Of priests and priestesses, not priests and mothers. Of kings and queens, not kings and mothers. There we do work for husbands and wives, not priesthood holders and wives. For fathers and mothers, not priesthood holders and mothers. For parents and children, not priesthood holders, spouses, and children. The essence of the priesthood, as I understand it, is twofold: to perform the ordinances and to preside. The Doctrine and Covenants tells us that in the ordinances the power of godliness is manifest, and without the ordinances and the authority of the priesthood, the power of godliness is not manifest unto men. Section 84, 20 and 21. and the Melchizedek priesthood holds the right of presidency, and has power and authority over all the offices in the church to administer in spiritual things. 107:8. Being a provider or protector has nothing to do with the priesthood itself. It just happens that most priesthood holders are also providers and protectors. They are because of our social mythology, not because of anything to do with the priesthood. It is significant to me that also in the Doctrine and Covenants, it states that the rights of the priesthood are inseparably connected with the powers of heaven, and that the powers of heaven cannot be controlled nor handled only upon the principles of righteousness. The powers of heaven are not controlled by the principles of maleness or fatherhood, but only upon the principles of righteousness. I find nothing inherently male about the rights of the priesthood. Certainly, righteousness is not the exclusive domain of men. There is, likewise, no connection between being male and being capable of performing ordinances or presiding. Female workers perform the holy ordinances of washing and anointing in the temple, and thousands of relief societies and single female parent families survive and succeed throughout the world. The only significantly male aspect of the priesthood is its history, and I do not want to deny that that history is important. There is no way around the fact that all priesthood holders of whom we know are or were men, with the possible and problematic exception of Deborah. About the same time in my life as the after-the-fireside discussion with our friends, I began thinking a lot about the priesthood. I was bothered by the subtle elitism and chauvinism I saw and to some degree felt. What, I wondered, gave me the right as a male to hold the priesthood? For a long time, I asked the question in terms of better than, i.e., what makes me better than Nancy that I hold the priesthood? I even experimented with the inverse. What makes her better than me that gives me the need to hold the priesthood? I never found the answer in terms of better than. I think that the dilemma is analogous to the problem the church faced vis-a-vis the blacks and the priesthood before June 1978. The world answered in terms of better than, but believing Mormons who loved God and his prophets could not. There was only one answer for me then. It seems wrong to me, but I believe in God and in his prophets when they speak, and they have not yet spoken. I find nothing that indicates that there is anything inherently and essentially male about the priesthood. Why, then, do only men hold the priesthood? I do not know, other than that God and his prophets have not yet spoken. But unlike the black question, we have no promise that they will speak. I am not sure that it really matters whether they do or not. Because I see the priesthood as something distinct and separate from maleness and femaleness, fatherhood and motherhood, the way men and women, fathers and mothers, relate to it is what is important. In terms of eternal progression, the fact that men and fathers must hold the priesthood sustains challenges and conflicts that are no less real and rewarding and anxiety-bound than the fact that women cannot. Thank you.
I'd like to, if I can, make my comments as brief as possible, but yet to do justice to the work that has gone into the papers. I stand here wondering why I have been selected to respond to what I found to be two very interesting approaches to the problem, a similar problem, I might add. No answer came to my mind, and I'm sure that many of you are as qualified, perhaps more so than I am, to offer the responses. I hope that I will reflect some of your feelings and may offer even some insights. The first paper I'd like to deal with is, as they were presented in order, The Marriage of Adam and Eve, a Male and Female Dichotomy. If I can, perhaps I'd like to restate the premise again, as at least I understood it, so you know at least what I am basing my response upon. The premise, as I saw it, essentially fell into two notions, and they were as follows. Concepts and ideas and possibly even things in life, which may by their very nature stand in opposition to one another and of necessity modify and or balance each other and are therefore both required to make a new whole, essentially the concept of opposition. But we had a second wrinkle added to that notion, which was that these opposing things, concepts, or ideas can be divided into two categories, one with seeming male traits and a second co-equal category representing female traits, both of which are needed. My response to that assumption, assuming that that's a reasonably accurate representation of the thesis, is that I agree with the first notion, that being the notion of opposition, and I believe it to be one of the great engines in Mormon theology. The second premise, that of the division of that opposition into the categories of male and female, I believe is an inappropriate and inaccurate classification of the character and process of opposition, and may in fact be a contradiction to other fundamental elements of the gospel notion. First, let me identify those areas of the premise that I do agree with. One would, of course, be the natural physical differences between men and women. That would be, at least from my perspective, rather ridiculous to argue with. The second notion is that I agree with is the notion of opposition. I think throughout our theology and throughout philosophy, we find that concept accurately portrayed as well as described. Blake, I'm sure, in his Marriage of Heaven and Hell, was very much dealing with the notion of the opposition of things. Again, as Mrs. Davis, I presume, or Ms. Davis, more accurately, has... I don't want to be too analytical about this. It's indicated that he, Blake, did not describe in his treatise that in fact the characteristics of heaven and hell were male and female. And I think that's an important notion because I think she has taken that beyond perhaps where he might rationally have gone. Conceivably, it would be possible for him to do it out of his sociology. In addition, her description of Freud, Lehi, are both, I think, accurate in bringing forth that idea that other people other than ourselves have identified the notion of opposition. From my own philosophical background, I could easily have included in this discussion Karl Marx and George Friedrich Hegel, whose descriptions of the dialectic in both dialectical materialism and dialectical spiritualism, I think, are demonstrative of the notion of opposition. We even have, in other philosophical contexts, Nietzsche and his Übermensch or Superman, who in part talks about the process of becoming, and I think implicit in the process of becoming is that dialectic. So in that context, I think that that I certainly would have no difficulty with the notion of opposition. However, the second premise, in terms of gender basing, or more accurately, in describing certain qualities as gender-based, I believe is wrong-headed and ultimately destructive of some very important notions that we have in the gospel. And I do this based on the following observations and impressions. First of all, I must say that the paper itself does not explicitly indicate whether it believes that the result of this differentiation between male and female is literal or figurative. The assumption, certainly, on the basis of the references to Adam and Eve, are that it very well could be a literal interpretation. Consequently, I would like to approach my analysis of the male-female dichotomy from, first, the perspective of is it assumed to be literal, and secondly, from the position that it is, in fact, figurative. If it is, in fact, a literal description, that men have, or maleness has with it, certain attributes of analytical. Let me read them more accurately as she described them in the paper. Masculine, heaven, has critical, analytical, orthodox, obedient, and is abstract. Feminine, on the other hand, is impulsive, creative, intuitive, and relative and personal. I believe that that notion is fundamentally a problem for us. And the problem stems from what I think is an essential element of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And that notion is a notion of individual salvation. The notion of individual salvation on its own precludes the idea of large categories into which people can be lumped willy-nilly or by virtue of their sexual gender. Individual salvation, essentially, suggests that each individual case must be handled on its own merits. I think if we look at certain elements, I think this notion, obviously, of individual salvation and individual responsibility is contained throughout the scriptures. But the problem becomes, as soon as we begin, if you will, lumping people for one element or another into certain categories, we lose the ability to be individually responsible for going on for ourselves. If we begin to suggest that as an individual you can only have certain kinds of attributes, then we begin to limit ourselves in terms of our ability to progress. Now, again, I don't know whether this is the implication of the paper because it was not explicitly sensed, but I believe this is a grave pitfall in the event that we want to fall into the trap of identifying in any category, be it male or female, notions of limits and categories. Secondly, I would like to refer to the article of faith, second article of faith, which says essentially, we believe that men will be punished for their own sins and not for Adam's transgressions. And in that, I think I will again make reference to this notion of individuality. I think the article of faith essentially begins to identify the fact of the individuality of everybody, and that no matter what the perspectives were of Adam and Eve, if we are using them as literal, if you will, role models or archetypes, that this begins to pose some particular problems. Let me, if I can, go back to to Moses. That's right. Chapter 4, verses 12 through 19, I believe, and suggest that, in fact, the interpretation that we have been offered as to the feminine aspect of Eve and her choice and Adam and his male aspects, I think, is actually irrelevant and is a non-essential notion as to what was really going on in Moses at that particular time. In my mind, and I will not read the verses, is that what if they are archetypal, and if they represent anything to us, they represent the fact that they were people making choices in a gospel that required that the engine that began it was done on the notion of free agency and individual responsibility. Why Eve chose is not really at issue. The fact that she chose is at issue. Why Adam chose, whether it was for Blake's hellish heavenly motives or not, is not really the issue. The issue is that he chose. And I would suspect, again, as was suggested in the second paper, that every time we make a rule, there are enough exceptions that essentially shatter that rule. I know in my own relationship with my wife that she often appears more as Adam would, and I often appear more as Eve would. But the issue is that choice is retained. Not that it was an analytical or an irrational choice. And I think by virtue of the fact that if we begin to attribute to these individuals a feminine and a masculine type of a choosing, that we begin to set role models for them that I think unfortunately are things that we will find ultimately will bind us. In a second notion, moving away from the literal to the more figurative aspect, assuming that they're giving the paper what I would conceive the benefit of the doubt, that this was not meant to be a literal explanation of how we as individuals should act, I would like to suggest that though my criticisms of the figurative aspect of it are not as gospel-oriented or based as if they were a literal interpretation, that they can indeed cause us problems. And I guess what I'm getting into here is a problem of semantics, in the sense that I believe the choice of female and male to describe those respective attributes is an unfortunate choice of words. It's interesting in Mormon theology that we are unique, if you will, from other religions, in the sense that our theology is not simply an academic study or discipline, but is in fact something that we attempt to comprehend so that we can in turn implement it in a physical reality. If you will look at the 93rd section of the Doctrine and Covenants, the clear implication is that spirit or idea must have its moment in physical reality. Consequently, if we begin to relate to certain concepts or attributes as either female or male in principle, as I think the logical flow of a Mormon philosophical notion is that we must ultimately then see those attributes in physical reality. Now, I would agree, I very often ponder objects, buildings, oceans, mountains, cars, and I intuitively sense, again, I'm in problem if it's literal because I'm not supposed to be intuitive, I intuitively sense that there is some sense of feminine, or some sense of masculine within them. I think the nomenclature that we often see of a ship as a she or a mountain as a he may in fact have some basic sense that we are relating to that object. I really don't know. But I think the important thing is to realize is that if we attribute certain attributes and characteristics, be they maternal or intuitive or other attributes, to the feminine, and protector and paternal or analytical to the male, that it is very logical that when we get into physical reality and we look at the differences between male and female, we will then begin to logically assume that those female attributes must then go to the feminine, those male attributes must go to the male. And consequently, I think we find ourselves enslaved again in role models that are in fact destructive to our ability to grow. I would like to think that as a male, I can be as much of a nurturer as my wife. And in turn, that perhaps patting myself on the back, and she'll disagree, she was supposedly coming, that she may become as analytical as I am, though she threatens that it would be the death of her. Or my death, one or the other. But I think the notion, again, is, to summarize, twofold. One, that if it is literal, we have grave problems in terms of couching our theology in that way and following a role model of Adam and Eve, because I think the distinction is fundamentally non-essential and is destructive of our ability to grow. If it's figurative, I think then the potential for abuse, for us to begin attributing certain motives to women, certain motives to men, becomes something that I think we are living with right now and probably could well do with that. One. The second paper I would like to respond to in more of a general way. Again, I would like to begin by stating its premise, which is clearly stated in the development of the paper, where it says, "It is my contention that there exists a conflation of the terms of priesthood, maleness, and fatherhood in most Mormons." And finally, "Is there anything inherently male?" The question underlying the entire discussion will be, is there anything inherently male about the priesthood? And the contention of the paper is to show that there is not. I find myself, which is unusual, in near total agreement with that thesis. Consequently, rather than focusing on the thesis itself, I would like to offer some of my own observations. The first, interestingly enough, comes from Gloria Steinem, who appeared on this campus, what must be 5 or 6 years ago now, and at one of my first brushes with the then burgeoning feminist movement, gave a speech that I found to be, or a notion that I found to be very profound. She spent the first 15 or 20 minutes describing all of the things that women could not do and that men could do. And she identified those in very clear order. She then, however, stopped and placed a caveat, and I should say that women cannot do in the current society, or at least were foreclosed from doing for legal or cultural reasons. She then stopped and very carefully placed a caveat on what she was then to give as the rest of her speech. She said, "My greatest fear for the women's movement is that we will, in our haste to equalize our position in society, adopt or trade one prison for another. The prison of the male, which has better carpeting, nicer lights, and higher salaries, for that of the female, which has less recognition, and conceivably foreclosure of opportunities in that regard." And I think I apologize because I have looked at it about 15 times and have forgotten it again. Mr. Harward, and I want to say Howard, and I apologize. Mr. Harward has, I think, very carefully and articulately identified that problem, is that we are both currently living in prisons. And the question is, what is the relationship of the gospel to those prisons? What can it do to relieve both men and women of what I see as fundamentally cultural baggage that we need not have in this day and age, nor will we have, assuming that we are all participants in Zion? Perhaps I can begin my discussion, or a brief synopsis, if you will, on emphasizing some observations that I had as I went through the paper. Firstly, I agreed that too much emphasis is placed on physical difference, in the sense that we start at physical difference and then we assume everything flows from that. It is my contention, as I believe Mr. Harward's, that physical difference are fundamentally biological, and that beyond the capability of bearing children and conceivably the actual sexual act itself, there is little, if any, activity that is not culturally based. Secondly, I would like to examine why, as Mormons, or LDS, since both of these papers come out of our milieu, that we have managed so carefully to adopt this kind of sociology. I think it's very interesting to look back at the early history, when in fact the church had separated from what would be traditional mainstream culture. And we find the development of different kinds of marital relationships, for better or for worse, there was polygamy, which begins to suggest that conceivably there is a different kind of male-female relation that grows under the notion of Zion. But even if polygamy, perhaps an aberration or some, I don't know, and don't really want to get involved in that particular question, but the notion that there were extended families that developed, and a different context, and I think we see that not only in the extended families that developed out of polygamy, but also in the very character of the United Order. Those orders, if you will, I think presented greater opportunity and greater equality to both men and women as they live them than the current sociological order that we've essentially adopted, or readopted more accurately, in about 1900 from Western political tradition and social and economic tradition. Consequently, I think that if we look at our history, we find that maybe if we were left alone, if the gospel was left essentially to develop its own political and economic institutions, we might find that a whole different sociology, a whole different acculturation or process might develop. My second point would be, again in agreement with his, that I think fundamentally, from my perspective, that the notion of priesthood is misunderstood in the church and certainly misapplied. And I am probably as guilty of that as any of my other male compatriots. When we look at the notion of priesthood, we begin to really, I think when we study it, begin to find the notion of light and truth, or the light and love of Christ, when we really talk about the notion of what the concept of priesthood is. Unfortunately, I think, because of the organizational propensities of the church in the last 60 to 70 years, the organizational elements of that have been emphasized, and consequently the elements relative to what priesthood, I think, is really trying to convey have in part at least been downplayed, and if not, and perhaps even lost. Consequently, I believe if we begin to re-understand the concept of priesthood and realize that our own philosophical and political and cultural traditions, if they were let to grow by themselves, would breed something fundamentally different than we find in Western culture, I think it leads to what is perhaps the most important element of what I would like to respond to relative to this particular paper. And that is, I believe that we have an opportunity as LDS, as Mormons with the particular philosophy that we have, and I beg the indulgences of those who may not be Mormon in the audience, to suggest to the world at large a different way of creating relationships. And I think it is the clear implication of this paper, Mr. Harvard's paper, that that is entirely a possibility. I find it very difficult to understand why we have been cast ourselves in the choice, or we are in the position currently, of accepting either one extreme of the culture, which is perhaps advocated by the most ardent feminists, of absolute individualism, females' right to choose in all categories and in all instances. And we juxtapose to that another cultural tradition, again not one of our own, of absolute motherhood, absolute isolation from the culture. My suggestion is that, in fact, the gospel and its attempt to promote people to the notion of free agency and individual responsibility, which is what I tried to reference in my critique of the last paper, combined with a proper understanding of the priesthood, would allow Mormons a unique opportunity to present a new sociological concept of how men and women can relate to one another. And I think it is a concept and a goal that we all too often forget as we jump back and forth between two options within a culture, neither of which is appropriate to the fundamental underpinnings of our gospel tradition. I would hope that as we all progress and learn, that we will recognize the problems and difficulties and really the lack of information that we do have on all of these topics. Again, in conclusion, I would like to say that as a male, as a priesthood holder, as a father, I agree and I believe, as Mr. Harvard does, that perhaps the reason the priesthood has not been extended to the female is, in fact, that we as priesthood holders are holding it back. I would hope, and again would also echo his sentiments, that whether the priesthood comes to the female or not, that there is enough level or area for growth, enough, I'm losing my way here, that there is enough potential for relationship and new understanding that we all, as men and women, can progress forward to whatever kingdom we aspire to in equality. Thank you. Now, if there are any questions, we have at least 4 or 5 minutes. I'm sorry for taking as long as those that presented. Certainly, please.
I would like to defend myself for a minute. First of all, there was some question about whether I meant literally that all men are in this sense masculine and that all women are in this sense feminine. And I really hope that I had made that clear, that that's not what I believe at all. In fact, I believe that this whole heaven and hell, Adam and Eve dichotomy is all right here. Perhaps many of you have heard of the recent psychological theories and physiological theories about the right and left hemispheres of the brain. It's more on this line that I'm thinking, that a person has to be unified in himself, has to have a balance of the so-called masculine and so-called feminine qualities in order to be a unified individual, fertile, productive, etc., individual. Also, I'd like to say that the terms masculine and feminine are not my own. They come from a long literary history. As soon as I became aware of this dichotomy, I started in my reading to notice these things. For example, when you read about the gods and goddesses, the qualities that turn up in goddesses and the qualities that turn up in gods follow right down the line. Also, in many works of fiction, I think, particularly right now, The Wife of Bath in Chaucer, Canterbury Tales. The Wife of Bath exemplifies just about everything that I would call, in this sense, feminine. Obviously, it doesn't apply to all women, or I would be home doing I know not what, if I were, in that sense, strictly feminine. But I believe, and I had hoped that this would be clear, please take it from me now, that every person has to be in himself married. Only then is my personal conviction that a real good marriage can take place between two individuals. If one or the other is lopsided or is not particularly married in himself, I don't think a successful marriage is possible. Anyway, I hope that clarifies things a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you. I was hoping that was her contention, but it certainly offered a wonderful point of departure for a point I've wanted to make for a long time. Are there any other questions? Yes.
My response is going to be ceremony as a woman.
That's absolutely correct. Well, I guess if I may respond in defense of myself. I think the notion that I was getting to are essentially perhaps a little broader based than that. But I think there's some difficulty in ascribing tendencies. And I think my second point, which is where I believe that fundamentally she was coming from, is the notion that those are unfortunate uses of the terms male and female, because the propensity in physical reality is to then ascribe them to particular people and begin to limit those individuals. I think, and it is my belief, as I think she has now expressed, that in fact we all should have an admixture of those notions. I think, again, trying to address the notion of Adam and Eve, is that I would probably fundamentally disagree with her in her interpretation of Moses as to what that means. I don't believe that the reasons why Eve chose, either masculine or feminine, are really relevant. The question is that she chose and she was willing to accept consequences. And so consequently, I think we probably do not have as much disagreement as you might suspect or I may have alluded to, because I was overemphasizing for a point that I believe that ultimately it is in our best good that we have all of those attributes. And if we begin to philosophically or for whatever reason follow a Western political tradition that divides them, we, in fact, may ultimately find ourselves in the same trap. That's what I'm concerned about.
Well, what I'm saying is, I don't think anyone disagrees with me to say that.
Well, then perhaps on a more academic level, the critique should be that as an issue that important, in my judgment, should have been made explicit rather than implicit. Yes? do you mean by that analytical or... that's one of the problems, and the irony in that is when I read the paper to begin with, I was intuitively bothered by it. It didn't make sense to me. I didn't like the division, and fundamentally rejected a lot of the early writings of Western civilization on that notion, because I think they have made a division in the culture that has grown into some sociological implications that are very difficult, that were not justified then and are not justified now. I agree, but I think, again, I would not disagree out of a Western intellectual tradition. My notion is, again, that traditional way of viewing this opposition brings with it a great many problems that I think are fundamentally antithetical to the gospel, and I think are things that we ought to very clearly examine. And I think, as I made in the second point, or was trying to make in the second point, that it is an unfortunate use of terms, though very, very often used. Absolutely, and that is my background. But I again would reiterate the second point that I attempted to make is that I think there is sociological baggage that comes along with the use of the terms masculine and feminine, no matter whether it's described in a historical or a literary context. And it is that baggage against which we must guard. That is fundamentally my perspective. I think it is in part a matter of perspective. Any other questions? Thank you very much.